I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to the London Review Bookshop podcast. To find out about our upcoming events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
Hi everyone, and welcome to the second gig of this tour.
Third, I think.
Third gig? Yeah, yeah. Third, okay. Are there more planned?
Yeah, I think we're going to go coast to coast.
Excellent.
And maybe one in Manchester, Nottingham.
Wonderful. Yeah. Okay. So I thought we would kick off by talking a bit about how this book came to be.
Well, I mean, they all started as pieces for the LRB or City Journal. But when the idea came up of putting them in the book, I picked ones that seemed to have common themes. And, I mean, there were pieces on Patti Smith, Kate Bush, David Barry that could also have been included, but they didn't seem to have the same echoes as these ones. And the more I looked at them, the more they had seemed to have two or three things in common. One, they were about white musicians whose lives had been massively affected by black culture and black music, or black musicians who'd had problems with white culture. And as well as that, there seemed to be almost a hidden autobiography under it, which at the time I really didn't notice. Even now it's hard to notice. I mean, it's it's deeply, deeply buried in camouflage, but I do think it is there. Mm-hmm. I mean, the story of how I was changed by black culture and black music and stuff, again, massively and unpredictably, and I wouldn't be writing about music at all if it wasn't for people like Charlie Parker and 70s soul music and Prince. I'd be off to art college and I'd be famous painter now, and I'd have a lot more money.
Oh, I don't know about that.
But here we are.
Because yeah. these are all ostensibly book reviews, right? But they seem to take what, you know, the form of what we understand by what a book review is and sort of levitate out of it and become something else. I wonder if you, like, do you think of what yourself as writing within like a certain form or not? Is that
Well, I suppose to compare it to say someone in the book like Bill Evans, who or any of the jazz musicians, you're given certain songs, certain standards to improvise with, and the songs or standards may or may not be great. They may or may not be complex. They may or may not be to your taste, but it's what you're given, and within that you try and sound out. I mean, you try and make your own soundings, I think, of what's there. You try and hear other things in it. You try and insinuate yourself into it. And I mean, I'd done quite a lot of book reviews before, but they'd been weekly book reviews, or, you know, they'd only taken a week to do or whatever. The nice thing about this is you can take your time. You can take months, or in the case of the Prince piece, years. I almost felt like I was in my own decline, like Prince, you know, because it took like 3 years almost to do. But yeah, it's not that I had a form in mind. It was more, I was just very lucky that years and years I had of listening and reading finally had a chance to be let out, in a sense, to play, I think, you know, because it's all right being a... It's all right being a freelance journalist when you're young, I think, when you're young and punchy and can run around. And but you get to a certain age and, you know, doing something in two, three, four days, I just couldn't do it anymore. Mm-hmm. And as I say in the book, I nearly gave up, in fact, because, you know, it's just... I just couldn't do that anymore. It's not fair to... the material, it's not fair to me. It's not. There's a quote in the Charlie Parker essay where it says... brilliant at a certain one thing that he does, but he gets boxed in. You learn how to use certain muscles, but you never learn how to use other muscles. You get you don't learn how to pace yourself, you don't learn how to, and that was the way I felt with freelance writing, in a sense. You know, you get brilliant at instant response, but deeper things about reflection, you know, are not possible in that sort of time frame. So this is just, you know, it was partly luck, partly my years of obsession and study paying off, I guess.
Yeah. You mentioned already about the kind of, I guess, the process of compiling the essays into the book being, well, revealing things, I guess. And you've mentioned about this kind of, like, united theme of the kind of cross-pollination of cultures. And I think that's one of the real pleasures of the book is you know, these essays that sort of come at you intermittently, suddenly being delivered in one stack and reading through them and seeing these sort of like latent undercurrents that are coming through that you keep returning to time and time again. And you mentioned also that that you noticed that there were these sort of autobiographical elements, sometimes latent, sometimes more explicit, coming up. But there seems to be a point in there is a point in the introduction where you say, "I've tried to write this several times, and I've, you know, you redact a sort of more explicitly autobiographical section of that." Can you talk a bit of that, about that?
Well, I didn't know why anyone would want to read my autobiography, basically, but. And it was a surprise to me, a lot of the autobiographical stuff.
You know,
it wasn't immediately obvious to me until, in fact, I reread them for this book, you know, and proofed them. And I was really surprised and almost shocked.
Right.
There were certain lines that just seemed to... I mean, no one else would see it, but I saw it, you know, like the Charlie Parker one I just mentioned. And there's several... There's a thing about in the mod essay about Bill Evans... where I write about Bill Evans and how there was absolute chaos in his private life, but he produced this beautiful, economical, simple music that is almost on the edge of something banal. Mm. But within it, you hear all these echoes and currents and things that suggest entirely other things. And that, to me, was the ideal of were you saying earlier what formed it? I didn't have a form in mind, but my ideal would be like Sinatra or Bill Evans, something that's really simple on the surface, apparently simple, that anyone can listen to or read, that doesn't put off anyone. But as you get into it, you may hear all these other undercurrents and things and echoes, you know. I mean, that's the ideal for me. And... yeah, as I say, it was a bit of a shock to me to see that all these things had been there, you know. I mean, going back to when I was 14 or 15, you know, especially the Charlie Parker one, and you know, it's a very odd feeling to see. It's like being in analysis or something. You think you've said something simple, but you know, gosh, you know, it's been there for decades.
Yeah.
You know, it's like.
Yeah, and that the dynamic you're describing between something which on the surface appears either simple or economical or elegant or minimal, and the kind of chaos underneath, that's something that plays out in all kinds of different ways, like again and again in the book. You talk about being attracted particularly to sort of musicians and to writers as well, who sort of manage to produce this elegant, economical work, and have, you know, their backstory, their life story is sort of sort of full of chaos and strangeness. And you mentioned in the introduction about that you feeling that there's something political about that particular tension. Yeah. I was interested to know what that was. Or
I think that's quite a complicated question, and I really hope to do a book on Billie Holiday, because I think she's the figure behind all this that isn't in the book. And I've written about this, although not published it. And that economy, I think, has to do with black people, black musicians in the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, and how they could communicate anger, deep rage and anger and perplexity in music that was not apparently full of rage and anger and perplexity. Music that was instead seductive and beautiful and sublime and light and dancing. And there's a great quote, I think it's Hilton Ahles talking about Billie Holiday, where he's talking about the tradition in black people in America of having good manners. And I think that, you know, whatever situation you're in, whether you call it cool or manners, at that time you had to watch every word and every action because you didn't know where it would lead, you know. So you develop this kind of mask of, and that's what a lot of the, like Billie Holiday stuff, it's beautiful, but you get the sense there's a mask there. And, you know, why is it? She's not a fantastic singer. She's not technically. But why is it 50, 60, 70 years that we're still all haunted by her? There must be a reason there. And I think that's partly what it is, because there's this undercurrent, there's this other voice under it, which is entirely musical in a sense, because the lyrics don't talk about anger. So she's insinuating this sense of the body into this quite banal song. And you can listen to, she'll sing a happy lyric and it feels incredibly sad. And she can sing a sad song and it feels uplifting. So, and in a sense, I think that's been deeply undervalued by music writing. Because I think a lot of music writing down the years has been about meaning.
Yeah,
it's like people, you know, there's this kind of Bob Dylan standard for music writing. What does he mean? You know, what's he really saying here? Who cares? But it's like, it's the opposite in that tradition, that black tradition, which Billie Holiday exemplifies, where it's the body and the rhythm and the sonics and the texture of it that communicate an other message to what the song seems to be saying, I think. And to me, that's incredible. I think it's incredibly complex and fascinating, and it hasn't been given its due, I don't think.
Because there is a sense, reading the book, that it feels like a kind of a rebuttal to the ways that sort of the history of pop music in the 20th century have sort of been made flat and obvious and about surfaces, and there's been a real lack of curiosity about these undercurrents, which are, you know, the things that you're seeking out. And as you were putting the book together, did it feel like a sort of like attempt at a reassessment or a rebuttal or
No, not really. I mean, it was more, I think it would have gone wrong if that had happened. It was more that I gradually saw that, you know, these things which I'd been thinking about for years. And like with Billie Holiday, I've been writing in private about this for years. You know, I've got something, these amount of pages at home about it, which a lot of which is unreadable and which only like 8 or 9 people in the world would get, I think. But I had to go through that process. I had to, and I've been thinking about it for decades, literally, you know, since the 80s. When I planned a book in the 80s, which was about singers and song and voice. And that's basically all I've ever written about, I think, in a sense, is voice and the ghosts that are there and the strangeness of song and singers and why we're haunted by certain voices. And in that book from the 80s, there was a opening essay on Torch Song, there was a huge Billie Holiday essay, there was a Ricky Lee Jones essay, and I think to finish there was a deeply strange thing on Elvis Presley,
right?
And as an apocalypse,
right?
Now, I have no idea. I was young. I was taking a lot of drugs, but it was. I've retained the title. I've transferred the title to this book, which is the Fast Birth and Slow Oedipal Death of Elvis Aaron Presley. And I don't actually like his voice. I'd never written about Elvis before that. Uh-huh. And that's the odd one out, in a sense, because I'd never actually been a fan.
Yeah.
I could see that he was important. I could see why other people liked him, like, you know, but the voice did nothing for me, absolutely nothing. So, mm-hmm. But I did find something in the end. And in the end, I ended up kind of really, really emotionally feeling for him, you know, because I think he was trapped. And, mm-hmm. At the same time, you know, he was like clawing his way out of this thing, but enjoying the fact that he wasn't succeeding. Again, I think it's really much more complex than anyone's ever, you know. And in that essay, I actually mentioned that, I can't remember if I used the quote, the thing about manners, southern manners.
Yes, yeah.
Black, white, it doesn't, you know, there's this tradition of no matter what you're feeling, you put on a smile and say, yes, sir, no, ma'am, yes, sir, you know.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the sense of Elvis, you know, being sort of stuck in something and trying to claw his way out of something. And I think that comes up with perhaps almost all of the people, the artists that you're writing about in this book, like this kind of exploration of the forms that a life can take, and the power of sort of, I guess you get artists kind of creating their own myths, and then the myths that are created on their own behalf, their own behalves, and then the kind of like limitations of the plots that they inhabit, this kind of conflict between, you know, like what are the possibilities within a life and how much you can do. And it feels in the end that so many of them end up not really bending that far from their original orbit. You know, they all end up in a certain kind of position.
Yeah, well, I think that was true of Elvis. I mean, it was like, in that sense, a very American life. I think, like Jack Kerouac, it's just a long journey away from the mother and back to the mother. And I think it was the same with Elvis. He was haunted by his mother and haunted by his twin and stuff. And I don't think he went very far at all. He had this huge thing happen to him, which could have been life-changing and was in material terms. But I don't think he changed one bit, in a sense. And it's a very odd... very odd life to look at. I'd like to go back to it, in fact. I think there's a lot more there with Elvis, but and with Charlie Parker as well. And again, we look at these lives because we think they're not that long ago, but the lives they led, 40, 50, 60, were so different. You know, it was like there was no media. There was no, I mean, LP records have only started being made and so on, you know, there was, and certainly in America, race relations were just, you know, well, abysmal and so on. So I think the, with Charlie Parker, it's fascinating. I mean, age has its effect on this as well, because when I was younger, I idolized and romanticized a life like that.
Yeah.
Deeply, deeply, and worryingly, and catastrophically romanticized. But as you grow older, you know, you learn it's not romantic. It's not in the least romantic. You know, it's something else, which doesn't mean that to risk some kind of Lacanian doesn't mean that kind of chaos and terror and pain isn't a form of pleasure.
Right.
I think it is.
Yeah.
And to go back to what we were saying before about people previously writing about this, I always had a problem with biographies of people like Charlie Parker and Billie Holiday, where you have this kind of tut-tut.
Yeah, it's like moralising.
Thing, yeah. Mm. Even, you know, it's prurient and it's kind of moralising at the same time, and it's kind of teetering on the edge of, you know, and Nina Simone is another great example. without trying to understand why this stuff was happening.
Mm.
And also what the pleasure might be in a life like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it just seems so simplistic in a kind of post-Freudian post, you know. Admittedly, things have got a lot better in the last... There's a lot more decent music books now. There's a lot more great writing about music, you know. But when I started thinking about this stuff, you know, I'd read a biography of Billie Holiday and just get so angry
yeah.
because it just seems so simplistic, mm. you know.
Because the book does kind of unpack this sort of idea of what excess is, and that excess isn't just about a kind of ordinary idea of you know, Dionysian pleasure. I mean, you say, I think in the case of Elvis, that excess was actually like... really profoundly about control
yeah.
and about managing a self.
It's measured out each day like a little itinerary. There's like Charlie Parker and him are like complete opposites, you know.
Yeah.
And of course Elvis didn't think he was taking drugs, you know. He thought he was drugs, you know. There was
yeah.
drugs and
they're not
was
real
drugs, you know.
Get them from the doctor.
And you know, you'd get it out and you'd take this much, you don't that, you know. But which, you know, again, you can be snitty about, but it's not, you know, it's not funny or, you know, he genuinely believed this. And mm. I think he had that attitude towards a lot of things. And I think he could have been incredibly good, you know. Mm. It's like the films are so awful. But there are hints that he could have been sublime. And I think the same is true of music. There's hints at the beginning and hints at the end that he could have been just fantastic, but what we've got is mostly the middle, which isn't mm. fantastic, you know. And of course you have to be careful, you know. It's almost like an experiment. Empathize with some of these people. If I'm writing it for months, you know, you can get
into them,
you know, but mm. you have to maintain a distance, I think, which and hopefully. And I think, you know, that they all did amazing things with song. And I think it's almost like a debt.
Mm.
You know, it's like I've had these people for all my life now, mm. you know, and I feel like I should give something back due, you know, like write about the music
mm-hmm.
properly, you know.
And mm. I want to, on that note, I want to ask about the Sinatra piece, which, I mean, people are... loving the book all round, but the Sinatra piece keeps coming up again and again. People saying, you know, you've actually caused me to return to this music and hear it again and actually be able to hear it. There's a lot of that in the book as well, isn't there? The idea that going back to something which you can't see or hear anymore because it's just quote unquote iconic or ubiquitous, and actually listening, actually paying proper attention. Yeah, I wanted to ask about the writing.
Well, that's my least favourite in the word in the world is iconic.
Yes, I know. That's why I said quote unquote.
It's the worst word in the world. It's done yeah. more damage, you know, as so many Friday night BBC 4 rock documentaries prove. You know,
yeah.
it's like, you know, why is he important? Because he's iconic.
What
it's
does
like
that even
a,
mean?
A circle that never ends,
yeah.
you know.
Why
yeah. is he iconic? Because he's important. Why is he important? Because he's iconic. Iconic is literally meaningless, especially when you're talking about something that's about music.
Yeah.
You know, and a sonic thing, and you're saying, well, he's iconic. What does that mean? It's literally meaningless, you know. But yeah, there's the Sinatra thing, which is the icon of, hey, cool, blah, blah,
yeah.
blah, you know, the Rat Pack, Las Vegas, you know,
mm.
and which, you know, it has some importance and so on, but it's very easy to overlook the absolute care he put into his craft, you know, and what an astonishing artist he was, you know. Was he an unpleasant man? Doubtless, a lot of the time, you know. But when it came to music, he was incredibly serious. And to go back to the theme of the book, he was obsessed with jazz, and especially with horn players. The first record he ever put out on his own label was Coleman Hawkins, I mm-hmm. think, you know. And it's like he just... I think those were the only heroes he ever had, you know, were jazz musicians.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. At the end of the end of the book is the essay about Prince, and you say in the intro that because it's a tremendously sad essay, the ending of the essay is quite, is, you know, it really sticks. And you say in the intro that you kind of wish that you had been able to, you know, maybe include other artists that fit with this kind of affiliation around the kind of commingling of black and white musics and the idea of home. And you talk about Solange and Lana Del Rey, and I'm just really curious what what you'd have said, how they fit in with this kind of idea.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't have just jemmied them in just in order to, you know. There were two things, one of which was Prince thing was sad. You know, it was much, much sadder than I anticipated, I think, for all kinds of reasons. One of which was I hadn't realised how much my life in the 80s was intermingled with his. It's completely and utterly intermingled with that music. I mean, literally, I can date my entire life in the 1980s according to Prince songs. And obviously it is sad, you know. Something went wrong very early on, I think. I mean, it's easy to think it was late on with the drugs, but I think it was much earlier. Something went deeply wrong. I don't know if anyone knows in Nicholas Roeg film Eureka, but where he discovers gold, Gene Hackman discovers gold early on, and then doesn't know what to do. It's like all that leftover time to kill. And he, you know, and reading between the lines, I think that's what happened with Prince. I think he had a fantastic life in the early 80s, middle 80s. And then he got this success and it wasn't what he wanted. It wasn't what he expected. Something went really wrong. And obviously for the end of the book, you'd like to have an essay which would point to the future and say, well, race in America has changed, there's hope, there's, you know, blah, 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 which I would have liked, you know. And I also had an essay on Nina Simone that I nearly put in the book, but I thought that would be over-egging the despair and melancholy. I mean, beautiful and sublime as she is. And also there are no women in the book, which is regrettable, you know. I thought about Nina Simone, and I thought about hurriedly doing some gesturing towards Billie Holiday. But again, according to my economy of the debt, I couldn't do that. I'd have to do something proper and serious and respectful. So the thing about Solange and Lana Del Rey, especially Solange, was just to leave a mark that, you know, I am still listening to stuff. I'm not listening to A. And B, they are astonishing. I mean, in the last few years, you know, voices that have made me cry, Frank Ocean and Solange and Lana Del Rey. Although Lana Del Rey was more like falling, fainting to the floor and banging my head. But not for necessarily the obvious reasons. It was more like someone had designed this by committee for me.
Yeah.
It was almost too suspiciously good.
Yeah.
They put noir in and they'd put Phil Spector in and they'd put this in and that in, and it was these lines. Oh, you like the bad guys, honey. Is that true? You know, it's like, what am I going to do? I'm helpless. Helpless.
Yeah.
But more like Solange. It's the voice is just, you know, astonishing. Don't touch my hair and cranes in the sky.
Yeah.
Just, you know, literally play them on auto repeat all night. And with Frank Ocean as well, you know. Frank Ocean is perhaps even more fascinating. You know, he can practically sing anything. And Solange is interesting because I'd had a problem for 10 years with her sister because she's. Let's stop tapping at the window, woman. No. In that shorty 90. No, the problem was... the problem was she's... Beyoncé is fascinating. Obviously, any journalist, if you said, who would you interview tomorrow? Say, Beyoncé. Obviously.
She's
fucking fascinating.
Uh-huh.
But I don't know. The music leaves me cold. It's like it was made by a bot. It was like, made by committee. And if you read the sleeve notes, it was made by committee. You know, 18 writers, 15 producers on each song, you know.
Yeah.
And even the songs where she's supposedly passionate about something,
is she really?
Yeah. I'm just left completely cold. Whereas Solange doesn't have a voice. She doesn't have that classic booming R&B voice like a sister. But the minute I heard those songs, I was completely done in. You know, it's like she's got something in the voice that, you know, to me works, whereas her sister doesn't. Which is what you were saying earlier about the politics of economy is interesting, because why should a weak voice be more powerful than a powerful voice? It's, you know, it's something to think about and, you know, write about in the future, definitely, yeah.
This, thinking about the effect that Lana had on you of... But I mean, not all the effect that Lana had on you, probably.
We've turned into Pete and Dud here, I think.
Yeah, we have. Sorry, had to happen. No, but I'm talking about this thing of this is for me, this is made for me, right? That, you know, the whole book is, well, one of the organising principles of the book is this idea of home, but it's not like a homey home. It's not like a very comfortable place. And it's not even necessarily a place. It feels to me a bit more like it's a sort of way of attaching to the world. And it's music that provides that. And it, that feels like the sort of same sentiment. Oh, this is something that is for me.
Well, there's two or three different levels to that. Because if you look, I hadn't even realised, again, like the autobiographical effect. I hadn't realised that in each essay there's a different thing about home. Like even in the John Fay one, which there's a thing about him coming out at a late stage with this tale about his father abusing him.
Yeah.
Even though he had this supposedly idyllic American childhood, you know, and the mother occurs again and again. Again, someone pointed out to me, I hadn't.
Yeah.
Charlie Parker, Frank Sinatra, it's the mother again and again, yeah. Who, and Elvis Presley, who pushes them, who fashions the life, partly in at that time because they couldn't have a life of their own, in a sense, so they inhabited this other thing, and it's... And I identify with that to an extent, you know, and again, I'd say I wouldn't, why would I do a memoir? Why would I do an autobiography? Mm. But, you know, I didn't have a home. My family were originally from Glasgow, but I grew up, they were an RAF family. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there wasn't a hometown. You grew up all around. In the 70s in Norfolk, we were on an RAF base. My mum worked in this shop and... got to know this black American pilot from who came in and started. She mentioned one day casually that I liked R&B and stuff, and he started bringing in all these ex jukebox 45s for me, all these blues and R&B and stuff that I'd never heard before. And you know, I've no idea who this guy was or anything, but that was when I was about 13 or 14 or something. It completely turned my head around, you know, like pre-punk punk, you know. Mm-hmm. These incredible records, which in a lot of cases weren't that well known. You know, they weren't Stax or Motown or anything. They were kind of deep South soul and stuff, almost like the equivalent of rockabilly, you know, and got them home and played them. They were so raw and rough and, you know, but at the same time really elegant and poised. And that completely changed my conception of music at that time.
Mm-hmm.
But it was their home, it wasn't my home. But we'd somehow come together in this no place in the middle of Norfolk, which is which is saying something, because Norfolk has got a lot of no place. Take your pick.
I think it's a bit of the book where you're describing looking at a photo of Charlie Parker, and there's a quote where you say, sometimes I think we might discern more of the true story if we blur our eyes and dream a little. And it struck me reading the book that so much of it is, I mean, it's less focused on, you know, the sort of what really happened, and more about sort of trying to conjure... certain mood states or feelings. It's quite poetic. I mean, we've mentioned the end of the essay on Prince, but particularly that. And I wondered how important that was to you, that sense of, like, blurring the eyes and it not being this sort of tick-box exercise in sort of dates and places, and more about trying to conjure a mood. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, well, I mean, it goes back to what I was saying before about the great lost book in the 80s. That was an attempt to... I mean, at the time, you know, in the 80s when I was young, and there was so little to read. I mean, there was nothing in Britain. I mean, it's like the idea that Martin Amis was the most radical thing you could find, you know. And there was no great... I didn't know where to go, you know. And it was the first stuff that excited me was French stuff.
Mm.
And like Roland Barthes and everything. It was, and at the time, I wasn't... I'll admit, I didn't know what they were talking about a lot of the time. But it just seemed so... it seemed like a really exciting way of looking at the world, and sexy as well, and kind of there was no equivalent of that. And then on a trip to America, I discovered people like Joan Didion and other American writers, and I just wanted to read. It's like I wanted to write a book that I wanted to read.
Mm-hmm.
It's like I wanted to write something that were, you know, that was the equivalent of their work, but about music and song, mm. you know.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a Lorca book as well about deep song. Yeah, there was two or three books that were really important to me, Julia Kristeva and Lorca and so on. So I started writing this book about the voice and song. And as I say, I think about, you know, 8 or 9 people in the world would have got it. And it was really self-indulgent, but it was like poetry more than music criticism. It was like, and it was like trying to imagine what it was like to be Billie Holiday and stuff. It was wildly overambitious, and what would be called pretentious, you know. But that's, I think that's what you do when you're 20, in your 20s, you know. But down the years, I suppose what I've tried to do is refine that into a form in which anyone can read it, and it isn't, it's not show offy, and it's not hidden behind 5 veils of reference, you know. That, and that, what you said, the reaction to something like the Sinatra essay, hopefully I'm succeeding, you know, that people can listen to the voice and hear that stuff.
Because for a time, the words notorious and infamous were attached to your name, weren't they? Because you were smuggling continental theory.
Smuggling? I deny.
The continental theory, nothing else. I wonder how you look back on that sort of preposterous, the idea that you should be infamous for trying to get
preposterous, my lord.
No, trying to get Kristeva into an album.
Yeah.
Like, do you look on that as like?
Well, it was enormous fun. I think that's what gets lost. It was incredible fun. It's a bit like pop art, you know. It's like finding these objects and, you know, making them or collage or whatever. And yes, it was glib. Yes, it was show-offy. But, you know, I was very young. I'd never been to college. It's like, which was an advantage, I think, because you could let these things off, these quotes like fireworks, you know, at the end of the night. And it was flirtatious. And yes, but there's a great Gore Vidal thing where he's talking about Richard Nixon. And Richard Nixon reviewed this biography of another American president. And Nixon said, whoa, I'm going to do the impersonation.
You should definitely do the impersonation.
I never realized he was so sly and devious. And he said, and I mean those words in their very best sense. So I'd say the same about me. Yes, it was glib and show-offy, but I mean those words in their very best sense. You know, it's like...
I think it's a really good point to open the floor to questions after that impersonation. So
the only one I do.
It was a great one. We appreciated it. If anyone has a
big
question...
Big fan of Richard Nixon.
Clearly.
Just a thing to say to an LRB audience.
Yeah. If anyone's got a question, stick your hand in the air. And we've got a roving mic.
Put your hands in the air.
There's our roving mic. I think first hand was over here.
Hello.
Hi.
Is this on?
Yeah.
Cool. Thank you so much. It's so wonderful to meet you in person. I must say, after I read the Bowie piece and every piece of yours I've read since, it kind of had the same effect on me as Lana had on you, that it was made for me and so forth.
I'm married.
I've always looked forward to your profiles as being like kind of final words, or very definitive. Well, never like final words. I'd always read more about Kate Bush or so forth. But I loved like just the time you put into it and so forth. And I wonder, especially with the Prince piece being the most recent one you've published and so forth, like how do you know, in a sense, when these pieces are done for you?
When the editor tells me it's...
Deadline.
Do you ever have any freedom with that?
No, it's true, actually. I mean, it's been getting worse and worse. The Prince piece was extraordinary in that sense, but the other ones take months and months, but and the Prince one took a lot longer. But I've forgotten the question. What was it about the length of it? Okay. Why, how do I know when it's? Yeah, it's difficult because the way I write pieces isn't kind of A to Z beginning. It's more like a film, editing a film. And sometimes I'll have the beginning and the end. I mean, that was true with the Bowie piece and the Prince piece. I had the beginning and the end, but I didn't have the middle. and in both cases, I still don't think they're finished. I'd still like another few weeks, a few more months. It's a lot of it's to do with the rhythm of it, to be honest. And it's, you know, there's a compromise between what you'd like to do and what the format and context is also. And I'd also like a lot more white space sometimes between, you know, because again, it's a sense of rhythm. In both the Bowie and Prince cases, the pieces were almost like, it starts out really full of life and ends up in this really melancholy twilight state, you know, and you've got to find the rhythm, the bridge to get from there to there. Sometimes it's easy and sometimes it's not so much. A good example of that is I almost meant to dedicate this evening to Robert Frank, the photographer who died, who I was a big fan of. And I wrote a piece about him once, and it was all snaps. It was all paragraph, white space, paragraph, white space, paragraph. But there was a very specific rhythm to it and how it ended at the end. And ideally, I'd like to do that with all pieces, but, you know, obviously there's in the ordinary sense of economy, there's a problem here because you can't take 5 years on a piece, which is, you know, I need to make a living as well. So if there's anyone out there who wants to sponsor me, if there's any millionaires out there...
Yeah, patron.
I'm a big fan of the 16th century, and, yeah. You know...
We all do,
Would really like some... Yeah. Anyway, thanks.
Thank you.
You said music writing improved, you thought, in the last decade or so. And I just wondered how you thought it improved and what might be behind that.
I think that's a huge question. I don't know... improved... Yeah, there is. There's a lot of really good writing, but all sorts of... I mean, for a start, there's many more books. And it's fascinating. When I was obsessed with music in my teens, you know, I would buy anything, you know. But there was nothing. There were no books. It was very odd. And if you go back to that time and look, you know, in The Guardian or The Times or whatever, virtually nothing, you know. And if it was treated as a kind of little oddity, you know, a little corner in the arts thing, you know. Then skip to the 90s or 2000s, and even the front of the Daily Telegraph has, you know, it's like Oasis and Blur, that was the famous, you know. So obviously the culture at large has changed, there's a lot more books, obviously. There's a lot more biographies, and academic books as well, you know, and just on every single aspect, there's a lot more to. And the complex part, I think, is why so much of it is about the past. Why is it about, why are we obsessed with, you know, and in my own case, it's like almost in my own lifetime, music and the writing about it has been born, peaked and died almost, and then at the moment is kind of struggling to be reborn again. And the past is a very strange place, you know. It's like, and if you have the time to look at it properly, you can discover all sorts of stuff, you know. It's not just music, you know, one of my own interests is about surrealism and stuff, you know, and pop art. And if you, I've spent the last 5, 6, 7 years looking at that as well. And it, there's so much I didn't know, you know, there's so many artists I didn't know, so many odd things, you know. But then there's the problem, what we were talking about, Lana Del Rey and Solange, you don't want to be just talking about the past. You need to find a way of, you know, bringing the future into it. And I'm not sure, I mean, I haven't solved that, but it is a huge question that someone online said about my book, that it was great, but it was like a luxury tour of a cemetery, which I think was meant as a criticism. But I kind of liked it. There's no point in denying it. You know, it is, in a sense, you know. Except, I would hope, it's not glum, you know, and the melancholy that suggests. I would hope that there was a lot more light there than that. But there is a thing at the moment where people are obsessed with the past, even the recent past, you know. And I think I say in the book, in the intro, that the best books I've read recently were books about blues and early 1910, 1920. I've read a series of books that are just fascinating, because what you thought you knew, what you thought was true, ain't necessarily so, you know. It's
I love the book, Ian. It's absolutely amazing. Thank you. It's something that you said, I think, in the book and also on one of your recent podcast interviews about your obsession with the voice and how... I think, with the exception of Charlie Parker, I think the rest of it is an obsession with voice. Something else you mentioned, I think it was on the Word podcast, was this thing about how some music grows with you and some doesn't. And you were talking, I think you referenced, say, Blanky through in the Iggy and the Stooges album.
Yeah.
How you can't really go back to that, and it was in a certain place. But albums, I think you referenced Miles Davis's Kind of Blue and Steely Dan, and how these records do grow with you. What would you say it is about certain music that does that for you?
Well, I mean, you were saying it was about the voice. I think within that, you could say it's about tone. I mean, even Miles and Bill Evans and Charlie Parker have a voice. Well, there's a technical term, voicings, in jazz, but there is soundings, voicings. It's, again, what I said earlier about too much music writing in the past being about lyrics and what the great author thinks, you know, and meaning. If anyone spends any time with musicians, you'll soon realise they don't give a f*** about meaning. They have their own language, and It's about feel and tone. And if you spend time with, or if you learn to play, even badly, you learn that music is a different language, and it's about a tone can have a feeling, you know, as much as a lyric. Personally, like, for instance, to give a completely random example, about 10 years ago, I found this CD in a charity shop, Leo Ferré, French singer, you know, and I don't know why I bought it. It was a double live. I don't like live albums. My French is sketchy. I can read it much better than I can talk it or hear it. But I took this home, and it was a double live CD made when he was in his 70s or something, you know, and I had no idea who he was, no idea what he was singing about, or only a very rough idea. I put it on, and, you know, 2 minutes into it, I was in floods of tears, you know. Which is not unusual, I don't think, with singers. I don't think it necessarily matters, this idea of what they're saying affects you. I think in general it's much, much more something about the tone of what they're saying, you know. Or, a combination of the two. I mean, as it happens, the song he was singing, I think, in his 70s was Paris, I No Longer Love You. And he goes through this song saying, you know, I used to love you and I no longer love you, and goes through this long list of why Paris is a fucking hideous place to live now compared to... And then right at the end, he turns it around and talks about politics and young people think, well, maybe it's not so bad, maybe I do still love you. But, you know, but there was something about the way he sang it that just completely floored me. And I think partly the subtext of that, what you were saying, you mentioned the Stooges, is to do with aging and about how we age and how we live with stuff. And you know, I think there's a line in the book about someone criticizing Sinatra. They say, well, you know, it's the same, singing a song is the same in your 20s as it is. It's not the same. It's completely different. The air is completely different. The mood is completely different. And if certain music does, if you do live with it for 40, 50 years, obviously it's going to have some kind of separate life, I think. Completely, yeah.
Yeah, you said something about you wish that Prince would revisit this.
Yeah, that was the problem. I think because the rhythm went wrong, you know. You get up to 88, 89, everything he does is fantastic and seems to reflect things that were going on in his life. And then at a certain point, he decides, no. And then he just sticks to one rhythm. No, I'm a black guy. I'm only going to do this kind of funk. And it's a huge lie to himself, most of all, I think. And it's like he pretended to stop aging. And, you know, into his 40s, 50s, he was singing songs about partying all day and partying all night and all this rubbish. And he wasn't. He never did, you know. And one of the strange things about Prince is this, you know, that sex imp, to talk about in tabloid speak. I think a lot of his music is profoundly unsexy, in a very interesting way, admittedly, but, you know, you'd need a Lacan to work out what was going on there, you know. But and to do with his voice, the way he played with his voice and wanted to be a woman half the time. I think it's really, really... But I think he scared himself with that. I think he started doing these experiments with his voice and his sexuality and everything, and it so scared him that he just never again. And so for the last 20, 30 years, it's awful, most of the... Yeah, you know. Yeah. So that's really complex because he couldn't just click back and do good music or click back. And he'd been pretending to himself for so long that I'm not sure what he could have done. I'm not sure there was any way out of it, really, except for the drugs, you know. I think the only chance was that... I think the only chance is if he'd gotten into the drugs and allowed the drugs to establish a new rhythm. And unfortunately, I think he was taking drugs that were far too strong. But if he'd... I think drugs could have saved him. I know that's not a fashionable... I do. I really do. I think he'd held stuff in for so long. I really think that it could have, you know, if he'd gone away and had, you know, 9 months in an opium den, whatever, it could have, but the way he did it was all wrong, you know, and deeply sad, deeply sad. Yeah.
Got time for one more question? Over here, yeah.
Sorry, going back to Prince again, in your essay in the LRB, you talk about some quite unpleasant incidences after the death of his child and with his wife, Maite. And I just wondered, were there any situations where finding out more about kind of your heroes and so on, your musical heroes, finding out about the lives of them, if that in any way affected how you felt about their music? And then how that kind of goes into wider questions about how we reconcile kind of our personal moral values with the behaviour of the artists that we
oh,
love and what
yeah.
they do. And then how you kind of... the kind of willful blindness that's involved in fandom and how those things all fit together.
So. Again, that obviously is a huge... I mentioned it in the John Faye thing as well. Where, you know, he was dubious towards the end of his life. But the Prince thing, I actually left out a lot of the worst, you know, it was edited, and a lot of the more awful, distressing stuff was actually left out. He converted to Jehovah's Witness, and whether it was genuine or whether he used it as an excuse for controlling people, he was the whole episode of the child and the death and the aftermath was really appalling. He would have lost all his female fans if those details had come out. He was really appallingly insensitive to his wife in that episode. But, you know, again, not that it's... He was cutting off a part of himself. You know, he was, again, you can see it as a part of an arc where he was killing himself. He was just not allowing himself to feel. And how can you make soul music when you're not allowing yourself to feel, when you're not allowing yourself to feel pain? Or, you know, it's a very, very strange episode there. In general, of course, in the last few years of Twitter things and Me Too, it's become a much larger question of, you know, how much do we... and I'm not going to say anything more. Because it will turn into a Twitter storm. No, it's obviously a huge question. And I think if essays like this and so on have any function, it should be to try and get the nuance and complexity and levels of this rather than the social media, you know, this is bad, this is good. Because everyone knows lives aren't like that. Everyone knows that marriages aren't like that. Everyone knows that, you know, aging isn't like that. It's always really complex, you know. And which, to draw a circle back to the beginning... Yeah. Is why I love, you know, Bill Evans and Charlie Parker and Frank Sinatra and so on, because they can bring up these issues, they can suggest these issues with music that doesn't leave you depressed, that doesn't leave you glum, but it still brushes against these pains and, you know, longings in your life, but leave you feeling better going out than you came in. Which I hope the book does too.
Oh, what a perfect place to end. It's almost like you planned it.
I wish.
We've got to stop there, haven't we, Claire?
Yeah, should we buy some books? And
yeah.
Before you do, thank Jennifer Hodgson, Ian Penman. Thank you so
much
for being
coming.
Here. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening. To find out more about London Review Bookshop events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.